Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. 3, 2, 1. Now live from the Devil Radio Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning. Welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Here is your host, Mike Crute.
Welcome to the Devil Advocates Radio Show, the Monday edition. No Fancy Brian. Where's Fancy Brian? He's at Disney, sticking it to Ron DeSantis. Apparently, I got Evan here. Evan's going to produce me all week long. He'll do a fine job. You better. He'll lightly screen your calls at 844-967-2789. Looking forward to a big week. Hope Fancy Brian enjoys Disney with the family. But we got some politics to talk about right here on the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, and let's jump right into it. I like to think of this as like the Mark Meadows text dump edition. Monday. We'll get to that in just a moment. Also, I don't know if you'd seen, but Elon Musk, that rich guy, perhaps the world's richest guy, well, he bought Twitter today. And I didn't think this deal was coming together, but apparently he lined up the financing and it was persuasive. Something like $44 billion. That's a lot of cheese. Elon buying Twitter. And I'd like to talk to the Twittery sort of people here in the audience. I am less of the Twittery sort than my colleague Dominic. Dominic does most of the tweeting for the show. So less so I, more so Dom. The trash talking on Twitter, that's Dom's. Anyways, we'll talk about that. Perhaps also, a judge has ruled Donald Trump is in contempt of court. And I'm thinking he has always been contemptuous of the courts. That's sort of a no, you know what, Sherlock kind of a statement, contempt of court. $10,000? Seems like sort of a big deal. $10,000 per day. Be a lot of ching to you and I, but less so to Donald Trump, perhaps. But he fails to release the records that the court has directed and ordered him to release. So he is in contempt. Got a fine U.S. senatorial candidate in studio with me here in the world headquarters, Madison, Wisconsin, Sarah Godlewski. Sarah joins me in just a short while, 3:30 Central Time, like 20-ish minutes. So we'll look forward to her. And also we'll revisit a little of the Marjorie Taylor Greene. You remember her, the rep from Georgia, gave the big testimony on Friday. I strongly suspect the new text messages, the text dump from Mark Meadows, may have incriminated her, at least on a charge of perjury, if not sedition. So, anywho, let's jump into today's big show. And I think we're going to start the big show today with the dump. The text message dump from Mark Meadows. And these are not the first text messages we've learned from Mark Meadows. But let me tell you what's contained in now over 2,000 additional text messages from the former chief of staff to the president of the United States. You know, the chief's chief. He wrote the book. And he was cooperating initially, but there were thousands of text messages he tried to shield from the public, from the press, and now they've come out. At least a large number have. CNN somehow got their hands on them first. CNN's got some coverage of this story, but I want to start with, you know, perhaps the list of what you should know about the Mark Meadows emails. You know, sort of boil it down for you. Let's start with 7 shocking revelations. According to Travis Geddes over at the Raw story, here are a few of the shocking revelations, at least 7 of them. Thousands of newly revealed text messages show former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows coordinating efforts to overturn Donald Trump's election loss and the panicked reactions of former presidents' family and allies as the January 6th insurrection raged. CNN obtained, I was wrong on the numbers, 2,319 text messages Meadows exchanged with various figures in Trump's orbit between Election Day and the Inauguration Day, revealing their efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election and their fear is that resulted in a violent siege of the U.S. Capitol. So here, my fair audience, you fine people out there, here are some of the most shocking, noteworthy revelations from the private exchanges. You know, nothing but the best. You're not going to read 2,300 texts. Let's just talk about the most interesting ones. Number one, Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene. Featured her quite a bit on Friday. Gave some testimony. Some are trying to ban her from the ballot in the state of Georgia, you know, due to her prior insurrectionist tendencies. Apparently trying to use the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. But here's the number one takeaway, at least according to this author. Marjorie Taylor Greene was among numerous Trump allies and family members who expressed concern about the violence in a newly revealed text show Donald Trump Jr. Trump Jr. frantically urging Meadows to take action to calm the situation. This is when you go to the mattresses on. They will try to F his entire legacy on this if it gets worse. Now, that's what Trump Jr. said. I want to come back to that thought just a moment from now. I think we got something separate from Marjorie Taylor Greene. I want to kind of, you know, come back to her. First and foremost, the headline here, sources confirm GOP group chats discussing martial law. Evan, you were here with me on Friday, man. You remember when she was saying, I don't recall ever discussing martial law with the former president. Does that mean you didn't do it? Do you deny it? No, I just don't recall it.
Okay, Judge, Exhibit 5.
Yeah. I had watched that in real time, and I had taken note of it. But let me share a little something I think the audience should take note of. Again, referencing the 2,300-plus texts between White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and various Trump allies. One of those shows Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene discussing those group chats among GOP lawmakers. Now, I'm going to quote her. In our private group chat with only members, several are saying the only way to save our republic is for Trump to call martial law. Only she spells it wrong. M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L. So that's more like the Marshall Plan, I believe, as that was spelled. You know, so maybe that'll be her legal defense. Well, I didn't exactly know what martial law meant. So how could I be advocating for it? So anyways, it now comes to light. What, you know, 72 hours later, barely? Marjorie Taylor Greene testified on Friday, and we shared some of that testimony right here. That, she couldn't recall. Well, I hope this jogs her memories. She indeed did talk about martial law. A little bit more here. In our private chat with only members, several are saying the only way to save our republic is for Trump to call for martial, incorrectly spelled, law. Greene told Meadows on January 17th, 2021. Now look at the date there. January 17th. 2021. Well, the January 6th already happened, right? The certification of the Electoral College votes, she was going to object to that part. But this text message dates from after the January 6th. After January 6th. This is, what, 3 days before Biden's inauguration? And she's got a group chat with members saying time for martial law? 3 days before Joe Biden's inauguration. It's almost like, you know, she didn't want it to happen peacefully. The transition. Kind of like she was held accountable to saying, I don't think we should let the peaceful transfer of power to happen to Joe Biden. I think that was part of the testimony she was trying to, you know, someone tried to jog her memory to. I think the attorney's name was Selly. We'll talk more about Selly. So, here's the rest of it. I don't know on those things. I just wanted you to tell him they stole this election. We all know they will destroy our country next. Please tell him to declassify as much as possible so we can go after Biden and everyone else. This is January 17th. It's 3 days before the inauguration. She's still saying, you know, it's stolen. We all know it. They'll destroy our country. It's time for martial law. Well, that could be a little damning in hindsight, predicated on the testimony that, you know, no one believed her on Friday. But, you know, this is a little damning just here on Monday. I think someone meant to get this one, if nothing else out there. Now, CBS News independently confirmed those texts with Meadows through a source on the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Apparently, they've had this material since like December. Just spoke with someone close to House conservatives who have seen some of the group chats from late 2020 and early 2021, the source told CBS reporter Robert Costa. Cringed at the MTG text. Said the group chats were and remained stupid and everybody texted too much in them. If they ever get out, we have a problem. Well, damn, girl, they got out. You might have a problem. Especially in light of the testimony you gave under oath on, what was it, Friday? So, a little bit more here, and we'll come back to this. The different things that, you know, were contained in the Mark Meadows email dump. I guess it's text message dump. I should clarify. You know, it's going to be a little confusing today. I'm going to talk about text and tweets. Elon bought him Twitter. You know, when you're super duper rich, you just buy a social media platform. But here's the great news. I'm going to tell you, there is great news about the news of Elon Musk buying Twitter. You want to hear the great part? Donald Trump's social media platform, The Truth no longer needs to exist. Not as a social media platform. The Truth, the value of The Truth Social has gone down 44%. Trump's taking a bath while Elon is buying Twitter. Now, perhaps Elon will offer him a place on Twitter, you know, re-platform him. He's been deplatformed. Perhaps he'll be re-platformed. But ultimately, his own social media platform, there's no reason for it to exist if Elon's going to take all the stops off Twitter. Come back, devil's advocates, hardly any stops. The Monday edition.
If you're not turned on to politics, politics will turn on you.
The Devil's Advocates, the fix for political junkies everywhere.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Monday edition. A lot of breaking news today. Excited about some of the breaking news. Always love to see the headline, Donald Trump in contempt of court. That's a civil matter and not as big a deal as the headline might sound like, at least not the action that's happened today. Now, if that forces the man to actually make disclosure, well, it could be a bigger deal because I think if he discloses, he's probably going to go down, at least make himself. That's the New York case. That's about his taxes and the falsifying of the values of his property. So the disclosure they're seeking is probably the evidence of criminality. So I can see why you might want to shield that. We talked about Elon Musk, $44 billion. Wish I could buy Twitter. Apparently he's got the financing. He's got the jank. So that could be a massive change in the social media network Twitter. That's like number two, I think. But let's get back to the Mark Meadows and the text dump Monday. Suddenly they've come to the light, and we'd like to share at least some of the big takeaways. I think we're only up to number two. I better talk a little quicker. Number two, the big takeaways from the Meadows text. Trump Jr. and former Energy Secretary Rick Perry each texted Meadows, again the chief of staff to the president, the day after the election to discuss ideas for overturning the results. They hadn't even declared an outcome yet. They were already seeking means to overturn the results. And I mean, I get it. Don Jr., But Rick Perry? Oops, Rick, you've been compromised. Now, Perry had previously denied this, but CNN confirmed the message was sent from his phone because he signed his name and included his personal cell phone number. Number three, the former president's allies tried to blame the violence on Antifa almost right away, with campaign spokesman Jason Miller suggesting that Trump pinned the blame on them at 3:45 on January 6th. And GOP lawmakers started texting Meadows with the same claims within minutes. Like, they don't have a messaging platform. Capitol Police told me last night that they'd been warned that today there'd be a lot of Antifa dressed in red Trump shirts and hats and would likely get violent, texted Rep. Louis Gohmert. Always a viable source. So anyways, the narrative changed to blame Antifa almost right away. Number four, Marjorie Taylor Greene, we mentioned her, told the court last week that she couldn't recall discussing the possibility of Trump declaring martial law. But she texted Meadows on January 17th, 2020. Now that's interesting. Someone's got the dates wrong. I believe this article references the wrong date because January 17th of 2020 would be a long time ago. January 17th of 2021 would make sense, and that was what was reported in the prior article we read from. So anyway, she texted Meadows, I believe on January 17th, 2021, that would make sense, to say that several other members of the Congress wanted the president to do that, meaning martial law. And here's the quote, the only way to save our republic, follow what she called a stolen election. I don't know those things she texted. I just wanted to tell him they stole this election. We all know. Now, there is another Perry, Rep. Scott Perry. Takeaway number five. Rep. Scott Perry, a Republican from Pennsylvania, connected Meadows in late December with then-DOJ official Jeffrey Clark. You remember that guy, don't you? Who was pushing baseless voter fraud claims after Attorney General William Barr resigned, and Trump considered placing him at the top of the Justice Department. Mark, just checking in as time continues to count down. 11 days to January 6th and 25 days to the inauguration. We got to get going. Now, that's the guy that pled the fifth like 100 times. Didn't quite give testimony. More. Number six, the takeaway. Meadows was in contact with numerous journalists from a wide variety of outlets, but one of the most frequent interactions was with Fox News host Sean Hannity, who agreed to coordinate his coverage on Election Day to benefit Republican candidates in Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Yes, sir, Hannity replied, on it. Any place in particular we need a push. So Hannity's part of the club, right? Part of the team. And perhaps one more takeaway from the Meadows, Mark Meadows, the chief of staff to the former president. We got a text dump from him today, CNN. Well, here's number seven. The former chief of staff was also involved in planning the January 6th rally that preceded the riot. But Trump advisor Katrina Pearson, she's the she's the one that used to wear the bullet necklace. Do you recall her? Around the campaign time, you'd have noticed the bullets she wore around her neck. But anyways, Trump advisor Katrina Pearson was upset by the fringe figures who were expected to speak. Now, I always would have perceived her as a fringe figure, but anyways, here was her quote. Things have gotten crazy and I desperately need some direction, please. Pearson texted on January 2nd and followed up that next day. Scratch that, Carolyn Wren has decided to move forward with the original psycho list. Apparently Dan Scapino approved, so I'm done. I can't be part of embarrassing the POTUS any further. You know, when Katrina Pearson's backing off and saying this is going to embarrass the president? Now, maybe she was concerned about the boss. But the boss, if you'll recall, had all his buddies come out that day. We had Rudy Giuliani saying, trial by combat! And we had Donald Trump say, you know, march down to the Capitol. Let's put some pressure on him. And Mike Pence is only courageous enough to do the right thing. And then at the end, he threw on, you know, an asterisk or two. Peacefully. Be peaceful, because it was all peaceful, and if it wasn't peaceful, it was Antifa's fault. And how you got members of Congress, according to the text messages from Marjorie Taylor Greene to the former president's chief of staff. Oh, you know, we think there should be martial law. Well, on Friday, she couldn't recall saying anything like that. Didn't deny it so much. It just couldn't recall. Come back with us. More of the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Monday edition. Going to have a fine guest in the Madison studios. She is U.S. Senatorial candidate Sarah Godlewski. She is the current treasurer. Great state of Wisconsin. Come back. It's going to be a great Monday edition. Stick around. I know you will.
The Devil's Advocates, radio for the 99%.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Monday edition. I've been joined live in studio by a fine guest. She is Sarah Godlewski. She is the Wisconsin State Treasurer currently, but she is running to be a U.S. Senator from the great state of Wisconsin, perhaps to take on Ron Johnson in the general in the fall. But first, you got to win the primary. Sarah, welcome back.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to see you. New digs here.
I know.
New world headquarters in Madison.
And I'm really impressed. When I walked in, I saw this Donald Trump beer opener, which if it was after four, I'd be all in.
Well, it's, you know, kind of like you curb stomp the man every time you open a bottle.
I know. I like it. I like it.
Sarah, wanted to start about an issue that I think is coming down the pike and may affect the entire trajectory of the midterms. Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
And I know it's an important issue. Women's reproductive rights, obviously, you're a woman, and I think it should be important to everyone, but perhaps more so to your candidacy. I got to think here. With Jillian Bettino moving on, I think you're the only female candidate in the race.
That's correct.
And I think we're going to see some major change to Roe v. Wade, perhaps not completely throwing out the prior precedent, but then again, maybe we will. Sarah, are you prepared? Do you think this will be a change in the tone of this entire elective cycle come this summer?
Well, I mean, I will tell you, Mike, when I travel the state, this is something that does come up. And for me, even personally, I think about this a lot because we have a complete abortion ban on the books in Wisconsin. So what that means is that if anything happens to Roe, that literally women are not going to have access to making their reproductive choices because we have a complete abortion ban, which means no exception for rape or for incest. And so what I get really frustrated about is we've had this precedent for 50 years, Mike. I mean, we have literally lived under this for 50 years. Why hasn't Congress codified this into law? I mean, we have had the presidency, we have had Congress. Like, why haven't we just gotten this done? And to me, I think it's because a lot of our representatives, even on our own side, Mike, treat this as, you know, an extra credit project, don't prioritize it enough. And now we are seeing this, I think it's likely going to be overturned or completely gutted. And what are folks in Wisconsin going to do? And we're looking at states across the country. I mean, just recently in Missouri, they've now passed a law where, or they're trying to pass a law where if someone wants to get an abortion out of state, they can be actually held liable. I mean, it's just crazy how they are attacking women and reproductive justice. And this is something that I think is going to continue to be front and center.
Sarah, do you think the broader electorate realizes how precarious women's reproductive rights are at the current moment? How quickly this ruling could come down, perhaps as soon as into June, early July, but it's coming down. Do you think the American people are ready for this and ready to respond to this? And if so, what's that going to look like?
So Mike, I actually think about how Wisconsin reacted when the Texas ban went in place, the 6-week abortion ban, where literally citizens, for example, could hold people accountable for making these reproductive justice choices. And I remember I actually traveled the state going to these rallies in places like Oshkosh, Wisconsin, Mike, in Ron Johnson's own county, own hometown, they had organized a huge rally and said enough. And so I think just seeing what how Wisconsinites reacted, knowing about what was happening in Texas, and I think about what that and what kind of energy and what kind of just frustration that's going to the electorate's going to feel then in June. I think people are just going to say, I'm done with this. Like, this is a priority, and we can't keep thinking about it as some sort of side project, and we've got to actually vote someone in who's going to prioritize this, who's not afraid to talk about it, and who's going to get this done in Washington.
Folks, you are listening to the Devils Advocates Radio Show. Got a fine guest. She is Sarah Godlewski. She is a U.S. Senatorial candidate from the great state of Wisconsin, would like to be the opponent of Ron Johnson and would like to take his seat, the one currently he has held. He's the senior senator currently. Tammy Baldwin's our good senator, as we would call her. Sarah, the right is tremendously engaged at this point.
Yeah.
And they have been tremendously engaged really by a big lie, by a fiction. But I see it in the metrics of media consumption. It's off the charts on the right. And I look at that as sort of a precursor. The engagement levels of the right, they have convinced themselves, they've been misled to believe that the election was stolen from them, that somehow Donald Trump got screwed, and by extension, they were all screwed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, perhaps if Barack Obama had told us in 2012, if Romney had won and he said, hey, it was a stolen election, we would have believed our leader, I think. So perhaps I can give some cover to those that might believe the one they voted for. But at the end of the day, there's no evidence to suggest any of this was true. And Sarah, it's played out in the courts, it's played out in the recounts, yet we've got this tremendously energizing fiction, and somehow we're supposed to live our lives around this and pretend like the Gableman investigation's not happening here in the state of Wisconsin, that some gubernatorial candidate's entire platform isn't rolling back the last election and perhaps every election back to Bob Dole.
Yeah.
Sarah, it's energizing, but it's a falsity. So how do we defend democracy? Because their reaction in no small part was January 6th. It was a violent insurrection.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, you know, love the kitchen table and issues, love the agendas, but how do we get beyond this sort of battle for democracy? And where do you think it plays in your candidacy?
So, I think that a lot of folks are really concerned about democracy and what are we actually doing about it, including not just progressives, but I think independents. And when we look at who helps win these elections in Wisconsin when you're only winning by 20,000 votes, it's making sure not only we get out our base, but we cross over and we speak to independent voters. And it's been interesting because I've now traveled the state a lot and I've talked to Republicans. And a handful of Republicans that I've talked to, for example, they've said, you know, Sarah, I'm not voting for Ron Johnson. And I've asked them and I've said, well, why not? And, you know, in my mind, Mike, I'm like, was it spending July 4th in Russia? Was it, you know, peddling junk science? Like, what was it that you now have voted for him twice in the past and you're now not going to vote for him a third time? And every single person has talked about January 6th, disinformation, and how they view their role as protecting democracy is voting this guy out. And so to me, I think we have a real opportunity to use that to get independent and moderate voters on our side. Because what are things that we stand for? We stand for democracy. And we have seen that time and time again. I mean, let's talk about the Freedom to Vote Act. What the Freedom to Vote Act that right now we could get through the Senate if we didn't have the filibuster preventing us is it would make sure that every single state abides by the same audit rules when looking at an election. So they couldn't pull this crazy stuff about changing the rules and everything else. It would provide transparency, accountability. And the other thing that the Freedom to Vote Act would do, Mike, that I want to emphasize, is stop the attack on these clerks. I mean, that's the other thing that I get really worried about is I talk to these local clerks. They're doing this because they believe it's their, you know, civic responsibility. And yet people are attacking them for doing their jobs. And so we've got to make sure, in my mind, that we are talking to voters about this and how we are standing for transparency, accountability, and that's exactly what laws that we are working to pass in Washington are set to do.
I've Pardon me, you've left me speechless. My fine guest, Sarah Godlewski, and that's a rarity, Sarah. Sarah Godlewski is a U.S. senatorial candidate. Sarah, once upon a time, Scott Walker won a recall in the state of Wisconsin. Yeah. He won another reelection beyond that point. And I heard a guy like Roger Stone, who was a Donald Trump ally, said, well, he fixed five elections. And I wanted to believe it because I couldn't believe the guy had won these reelections. But as I've done a little research on the way elections are run in the state of Wisconsin, it's implausible. There's 1,850 different election clerks. It's so decentralized. You can't really pull off a conspiracy. I don't care how good you are. You'd never keep it secret. It would out. We would know. It would have come out in the audits. It would have happened. And, you know, you look at those that do the math. Even Ron Johnson, we've heard ads. Ron Johnson pointed out Donald Trump lost the state of Wisconsin because a lot of Republicans, I call them different things sometimes, Sarah, a lot of Republicans voted at the down ticket but didn't vote at the top. They found him distasteful. They didn't want to vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump is nationalizing, or at least would like to nationalize this election.
Yep.
He encouraged Ron, of course, to run for re-election when Ron was still playing coy and acting like it was a question mark. Sarah, do you see this as a nationalized election? If you win the primary, are you running against both Ron and Donald Trump in some way?
In my mind, I think that we will see Donald Trump here frequently.
In Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
Again.
Again and again and again, just like we saw him here frequently in 2016. I mean, I think of my hometown of Eau Claire. I mean, he spoke at my high school in 2016. We saw him again here in 2020. He came often. And so I do think that Ron Johnson will use Donald Trump as a way to try to rally the base. But at the end of the day, in my mind, I think what we do is we talk about what we got done for folks in Wisconsin. I mean, Ron Johnson, where was he with the infrastructure package, Mike? I mean, this literally...
Well, he was opposed. He was a no vote.
He was a no vote for it, which, what was that going to do? Expand broadband. It is going to fix the damn roads, or the Scott holes, as we like to call them here and there. And then it's going to make sure we get these lead pipes out of communities. And so, and what did Ron Johnson do with the budget process? Do you know how much money he brought to the state of Wisconsin? Nothing. He brought nothing to Wisconsin. He didn't put any money forward into helping our state.
Well, Sarah, in defense of Ron Johnson, in a twisted sort of way, he brought lots of bacon back to the state of Wisconsin. It was just in the form of tax cuts, and probably mostly to the benefit of a couple of billionaire donors to him.
Yeah.
Ron Johnson saved the Uhlines and saved the widow Hendricks, something like, depending on whose reporting you believe, $80 to $200 million in the single 2018 tax year.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a bring home the bacon, at least for a few selected people.
Yeah.
Now, Ron came to my former Milwaukee studios and said, Crudy, I did it for guys like you and I. We're both designated S. We're both small corporations with pass-through income that we've got to pay taxation on. But I didn't get a $200 million tax cut, Sarah. And he got a kickback of something to the tune of like $21 million. He's a pretty good investment for the very wealthiest. He certainly returned their investment. But no, he didn't fix the roads. But he did, you know, he did fix some taxes for some folks.
Well, and to your point, Mike, I think he said, oh, my wealth only doubled during the pandemic, when we know at the height of it, 1.2 million Wisconsinites were underemployed and unemployed and couldn't make their bills. And so for me, I think this goes back to, what am I talking about on the trail, for example? I mean, one of the policy papers that I put forth was a wealth tax. And we have seen it firsthand. I mean, something I actually talk about with my parents. My parents are two retired public school teachers in Eau Claire. And I'm like, it's crazy that they pay a higher percentage in taxes than my husband, who's an impact investor.
Yeah.
I mean, this system is so broken. And then we're seeing that fossil fuel companies, Mike, are getting subsidies still, I think, to the tune of a few $100 million. And every time you see a pharmaceutical ad,
I prefer the term corporate welfare, but please continue.
Mm-hmm,
Sarah.
Mm-hmm. I like that too. I like that. I'm gonna have to use that more, Mike. But even like pharmaceutical companies, every time you see a stupid ad, they're the ones that are getting tax write-offs for that stuff. So to me, this is like a no-brainer, and we've got to be working on this stuff.
Sarah Godlewski, a fine U.S. senatorial candidate. Sarah, I want to talk more about your platform, what you would stand for as a candidate. We'll come back with Sarah. She's here at the World Headquarters And if you're very, very nice, we'll let you talk with Sarah Godlewski as well. Dial her up at 844-967-2789. If there's time, we'll do a town hall style. But you know, Sarah, we've tried this with Rojo several times. Never works out.
It doesn't?
No, no. We've answered the phone and people will say things like, oh, I don't want to talk to him. I just want to tell him what a bastard he is. I'm like, well, that's not really playing nice for the format. So we'll see. Lightly screened phone calls. And I know who the super conservatives are. CJ, you're not getting through. But anybody else, consider calling 844-967-2789. Devil's Advocates, back to the world headquarters. Our fine guest, candidate, Sarah Godlewski, U.S. Senate.
The Devil's Advocates, political commentary from the back of the class.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates radio show. I've got perhaps the smartest girl in the class. She is Sarah Godlewski. She is a U.S. senatorial candidate. And we were always the guys sitting in the back clowning a little bit, Sarah. So forgive me if I missed a few of the lectures. You talked about a wealth tax. Around here, we talk a lot about income disparity. I was a Bernie guy. I believe that we can find commonality, independents, Republicans, Democrats, all care about paying the bills, our own bills, and sometimes the government bills as well. And I think we all feel that corporations are certainly not taxed fairly, not the big corporations. They're not paying their fair share. And a lot of that falls back then on the middle class taxpayer. If the big corporation's not paying anything, then we got to pay. So how do you help recapture some of the wealth? I mean, if Elon Musk can go pay $44 billion for Twitter, can the man pay some taxes, for Christ's sake?
Well, yeah, and to your point, Elon Musk, what, made $132 billion during the pandemic? So maybe that $44 billion that he just used to buy Twitter, he should have actually just been paying for his taxes. But I think, look, if there's something that we know is front and center, it's we've got to reevaluate our tax code, because there is no way that folks like Ron Johnson or Elon Musk get away with paying nothing. It just doesn't make any sense. So we tax income but not wealth. So the rich just keep getting richer. And this is where I think, and I could dork out about this, Mike, all day, but Senator Wyden, who is one of the chairs of the Financial Services Committee, has really been thoughtful, I think, in how we can actually effectively tax wealth and make sure that we're evaluating it and we put a percentage on it. Because right now, if somebody who is wealthy, let's say, you know, let's just use like a piece of art, for example, that goes up in value, you're not taxed on that. Or if an investment goes up in value, you're not taxed on a lot of that stuff.
Not until you sell it and realize it, and you know, you can borrow against it the rest of your life if you've got an asset. So you never have to actually sell the underlying asset. What about a windfall profits tax? Obviously, during this pandemic, you know, we've seen certain sectors blow up and have done really well. And then we see some that seem like they're profiteering. They're blaming the inflation on Joe Biden, but they're making record profits. So how do we stem the record profits, or at least call enough attention to it that the American people say, you know, I am taxed enough already. How about Exxon pay a little? How do we do that, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you hit two of the industries. Well, let's even say three of the industries. We've got big tech, right, where I think that we've got to look at where that can profiteering and kind of windfall can boot in play. Let's also talk about pharmaceutical companies. Actually, something, Mike, that I talk a lot about is what I get frustrated about with pharmaceutical companies is they get these tax write-offs, but at the same time, we're the ones that pay up front for them to even develop these drugs. And so to me, we not only need to make sure that we are stopping price gouging, but at the same time, if they're getting public money to make these drugs, we've got to then not only make them pay it back, but we should even have an accountability tax on top of that. So I think that there are ways with the same thing with with fossil fuel industries. As I mentioned right before the break, they're getting still tax subsidies to date, which is crazy to me. And how much have they been making?
Even corporate welfare.
Exactly. Exactly. It is just frustrating. And I think the other thing that we got to keep talking about that isn't is Let's talk about the audits of these companies. We know right now the IRS is not equipped to actually do a lot of auditing for these companies to make sure they're not taking these kind of back alley ways of skipping taxes. And so this is, I think, something else that needs to be front and center is we've got to make sure the IRS has the staff that they need to be auditing these large corporations so that they're paying their fair share. So to me, it's kind of this multifaceted approach.
Sarah, there are four primary, at least I would call them first-tier candidates. You, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Mandela Barnes, and Mr. Lasry. And I see Daniel Bice is out there writing another column, and that's what he does. He writes columns about candidates. Apparently, every single one of these candidates has been touched, including yourself, by Amazon and Walmart and some different stocks. Now, I understand you have perhaps sold off the stocks in question, but Alex Lasry says he's not going to sell off the stocks. And ultimately, Amazon is a corporation that's been fighting the unionization efforts at their warehouses. Sarah, where do you stand on the union efforts? And, you know, as a secondary note, do you have to sell off your entire stock portfolio and hold it in cash? Because then you're subject to only doubling your wealth like Ron Johnson.
Right. Well, Mike, look, you know, I'm a proud product of a union family. And something that I learned at a very early age is that my parents said, look, Sarah, we've got good wages, we've got good benefits, and we've got good working conditions. Why? Because the union fought for it. And so for me, knowing that, I have really lived my values. When I became state treasurer, one of the things that I was really proud about is working with other state treasurers to address corporate abuses with workers. So I band together, for example, when Amazon during the pandemic wasn't providing PPE or paid time off for employees that were sick, me and a bunch of other treasurers said, knock it off. Like, when you don't take care of your workers, this is a huge risk. And there's going to be consequences. Or the same thing when they were meddling with Amazon trying to unionize in Alabama, the same thing. We said, knock it off. And so to me, I think one of the things that I have tried to think through is how can I actually use my investment authority to help holding corporations accountable? And I think there needs to be more and more of these activist investors that are using that voice.
Sarah, recently Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post, she wrote up the four primary candidates in the race, but she pointed to you as sort of a pragmatic, a good choice here in the state of Wisconsin. But then she also pointed out you trail. You're not currently the front runner in the polling we've seen. So, Sarah, you know, starting to get to be a sprint. How do you catch the front runner? How do you win the nomination? You know, I can give you like 90 seconds to win the nomination, sister. How do you do it?
Well, look, Mike, if there's one thing that I can tell you, it's I've been underestimated my entire life, whether that was my time getting and starting my own business, to working at the Pentagon, to stopping Scott Walker's power grab, to actually flipping more Trump counties than the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. And to me, there's just too much at stake. And just like I worked hard and delivered as state treasurer, I'm going to do the exact same thing in this race. We're listening to folks. We're traveling the state. We're getting out there. We're on air in all seven media markets. And so to me, once I get my message out, I really believe that Wisconsinites are going to see that. And I'm the best candidate to beat Ron Johnson.
Sarah, if people want to support your campaign, how do they do so? Give them the website.
They can go to sarahforwisconsin.com. And that's Sarah with an H, all spelt out, sarahforwisconsin.com.
Sarah Godlewski, a fine U.S. senatorial candidate. Sarah, we've already invited you to a couple of the big summer events. I know it's going to be a sprint. We look forward to seeing you at the finish line. Come back with us. More Devil's Advocates. I guess it's the happy hour. And then the happier happy hour when Dom joins us. But you're going to stick around for all 3 hours. That's all we ask. 3 hours, 5 days a week. Thank you so much, Sarah Godlewski.
Thanks for having me.
Into the future.